have a thought to share with you tonight, but in preface to it, many of you know that it was only just last week that we returned to a full Oneg here in the building with food and drinks and everything. We had had our Togoneg, as Mark Goldman had named it many, many months ago, but we're able to now resume both the camaraderie and the eating, which has always been such an important part of temple life. And Deborah Pelaez has once again stepped forward to be our Oneg coordinator, at least for these months as we get up and started. So Deborah, in honor of you and our Onegs that you have helped us to provide, I offer these words in this teaching tonight in appreciation. Now, you know that last week was Purim, with a lot of fun, Megillah readings, spiel, carnival. How many of you were here for some or part or all of Purim? A good number of us. How many of you ate a Hamantaschen? At least one, some fantastic. All of these are great customs and rituals and parts of the holiday. But for me, there was one new ritual this year that I did not like. It actually had nothing whatsoever to do with the holiday itself, but it had to do with the grocery store. You see, the week before Purim, Wegmans in Fairfax had out their display of all of their Passover food. This is sort of like how CVS near us spent the night of Halloween getting rid of their Halloween candy and putting out their Christmas candy, right? Or how as soon as December 26th came around, it was all Valentine's everywhere, right? So I was worried that Wegmans would sell out. So I went and I did some, a good chunk of my Passover shopping before Purim had even happened. Now, the truth is, I like Passover. I like Passover food. I tend to be pretty stringent, actually, when it comes to the food rules on Passover. We'll talk more about that another time. But my family will tell you that I take it pretty seriously. The notion of the rules for Passover and eating for Passover are actually not in this week's Torah portion. It comes a little later on and develops over the centuries. But this week's Torah portion does have in it an initial listing of animals that were permitted or forbidden to the ancient Israelites. If you were a land animals could be eaten if they had cleft hoofs and chewed their cud. They had to do both of those two things, and then they were qualified as pure to be able to be eaten. If it was a sea creature, it had to have fins and scales. There's actually no rule, general rule given for birds, but there are specific types listed. I'm sorry to inform you, the Bible tells us you may not eat vultures, falcons, ravens, hawks of any kind, pelicans, or bats. Not that I think we're serving that at Oneg, Deb, please make a note. This listing in this portion in Leviticus is actually the start of a system that develops into kashrut, into keeping kosher. There are other sections later on in Torah that repeat this list, give a few more details, including the admonition not to boil a kid in its mother's milk. And from these sections, it gives rise to a whole system of laws that we may be familiar with. Over the years, through Rabbinic Judaism and modern Judaism, we got to the complete separation of milk and meat, of milchic and fleshic dishes, separate set of utensils, separate set of flatware. Some even go so far in some homes to have separate dishes, or I've heard of a home that even had separate dishwashers for milk and for meat. There's a whole taxonomy of different certifications and symbols and what certifies as kosher. All of this isn't actually in the Torah, but grew from it. And this week's portion is the start of our dietary laws. Now, I don't tell you any of this to inculcate a sense of guilt by any stretch. And actually what I'll share with you is that Reform Judaism over the years has had, well, let's call it a complicated relationship with kashrut. So whatever your personal relationship with kashrut is, it's all fine, it's all good. I'm not advocating for one or the other and certainly not implying any guilt. Guilt doesn't come until Yom Kippur, so we have a little time. In early American Reform Judaism, they disdained kashrut to the point of abolishing it altogether. In 1885, a group of Reform rabbis meeting in the city of Pittsburgh crafted a platform for what we believed about Judaism as Reform Judaism, and they said, "We hold all such Mosaic and rabbinic laws as regulate diet, originated in ages and under the influence of ideas altogether foreign to our present mental and spiritual state. They fail to impress the modern Jew with a spirit of priestly holiness. Their observance in our day is apt rather to obstruct than to further modern spiritual elevation. Did you catch all that? Not only did they say kashrut was outdated and outmoded, it might even get in your way of a spiritual connection to Judaism. It's what the rabbis, the Reform rabbis in 1885 said. Almost a century later, by 1979, in a book on Reform Jewish practice, we saw an eventual evolution of Reform Jewish thinking about it. The book noted that some Reform Jews will observe different kinds of kashrut. They might observe a biblical style, not eating pork or shellfish, or they might observe the full set of traditional rules, or they might observe nothing at all, but the book recommended every Reform Jew to study and to consider how some system of kashrut might fit into their home. By 2001, we had a statement, a book published by Rabbi Dr. Mark Wachowski, who is a professor at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion and really the dean of our response of our law committee. And he pointed out that there are different reasons why a Reform Jew might actually choose to keep kashrut, whether it's identification with contemporary or historic Jewish religious experience, the authority of the religious tradition itself, the desire to have a home in which any Jew could eat, a desire to place limits on one's diet as an expression of ethical responsibility to nature. He wrote that Reform Jews could choose to keep kashrut as a mode of religious life, that it's not an all or nothing kind of option, but that you might abstain from forbidden species of pork and shellfish, or you might separate milk and meat, or you might consume only kosher meat. He wrote, Reform Jews may decide to observe all of these practices, some of them or even none of them. They may decide to observe them at all times or only when dining at home. Again, the choice is left up to the individual and the household. Kashrut, he wrote, can mean different things to different Reform Jews. I think that is the case today. Different Reform Jews will observe kashrut differently. I'll tell you, when I was in rabbinic school, I had a rabbinic school friend, grew up to be a rabbi, who intentionally, on purpose, would go out onto the streets of New York City and get an Italian sausage sandwich with peppers and onions. And on the opposite hand, I had rabbinic school classmates who had separate sets of dishes and kept a very strict milk and meat separation. For me, personally, the question of what I eat and how I eat it combines many of these ideals. I resonate with that historical connection and with the sense of peoplehood and with wanting to be deliberate and thoughtful about what it is that I eat. I grew up eating cheeseburgers and shrimp cocktails, but I made the choice in high school and then in college and then beyond about how I choose to observe. I don't require a heksher on kosher meat, but I won't eat milk and meat together or pork or shellfish. I have family members on all range of the spectrum from all eating all different kinds of ways from all the different branches of my family. Now, interestingly, more recent times have raised additional questions that our ancient rabbis couldn't have foreseen. For example, do you all know what an impossible burger is? Right, that's a plant-based burger, no meat in it whatsoever. Can you eat it with cheese and be kosher? If you 3D print out of plant-based substances a pork chop or bacon, can you eat that and consider it kosher? We don't know, right? They're plants, and yet there is probably the rule, the sentiment is going to be no because of a concept called ma'arat ayin, which means the misleading eye. Somebody walking by might see you eating that, think it was the real thing, and not understand what it was that you were doing. But the jury is still out because we're still facing these questions. There also have been reinterpretations of standard notion of kashrut. There's a sense of eco-kashrut. Is what I am eating being grown in an earth-friendly kind of way? What pesticides are being used? Is it sustainable coffee in Central America or fair trade chocolate? Is it wild-caught salmon, not farm-raised? What's the impact on the environment? Concern for the world around us beyond what we put inside of us is another way of considering kashrut. There also is, in the last decade or two, a group from the conservative movement in Judaism that has been reviving a sense of ethical kashrut called Magen Tzedek. Kosher food, they say, has got to be produced in keeping with Jewish ethics in labor or animal welfare or environmental impact or corporate integrity. A kosher meat packing plant with unsafe working conditions, with unfair labor practices that mistreats their workers, doesn't get the Magen Tzedek seal of approval. Chickens raised in 2-foot coops instead of being able to roam free, having fair business practices, no shady deals, no child labor, but fair wages and benefits for your workers, truth in advertising, quality products, to earn their stamp of approval, you have to meet these Jewish ethical requirements and not just the ritual ones. In truth, this actually isn't a new concept, it's just newly emphasized. There's a story told back in the 19th century of Rabbi Israel Salanter, who was called to certify the kosher status of a matzah factory. The Salanter was one of the leading lights of the Musar, of the ethical movement in Judaism in the 19th century. He saw that the matzah was being made according to the letter of the law, but he refused to give certification. Why? Because of the poor treatment of the workers. The women in the factory were overworked, their pay was insufficient, their needs were ignored. His moral compass, writes Dr. Shmuley Yanklowitz, would not allow the consumption of products prepared unethically. Rabbi Salanter refused to certify the factory's matzah as fit for use on the holiday, on the very holiday when Jews tell the story of their ancestors' release from enslavement. These notions of kashrut, as I said, stem from this week's Torah portion. The notion of food and of eating is a very Jewish thing. We've been doing that for a long time as well. But the idea then is not if we keep kosher, but how kashrut comes to inform what we choose to eat. On this Shabbat, as we read the initial listing of these permitted and forbidden foods, the start of the dietary laws, let us pledge to always be aware of what it is that we consume as food, how it is grown and raised, how those who work are treated, how it impacts our earth. Let us be mindful to make conscious choices about our connection to our past, our connection to our community, our connection to holiness. Let us each consider not if we keep kosher, but how we relate to these concepts, and how we can find a way for ethical and ethnic considerations to play a role in the food that we eat. Enjoy the oneg, everybody. Shabbat shalom. We will enjoy the oneg in just a little bit. As we do, we will get a chance to celebrate not only Shabbat, and not only with Davin in anticipation of tomorrow morning, but we have the opportunity tonight also to celebrate a moment of joy for a happy couple, a son of this congregation, as he begins to make preparations for his wedding. And so we are so glad to have tonight Ricky Cowaite and Allison Urbashevsky. We invite you guys to come on up with me up here to the Bema if you would. Make sure that the new mic is working fine for that. They are the children of Rick and Sue Cowaite, of Carla, David, and Nancy Rubashevsky. They're going to be married at the end of June, at the end of May. And tonight they're coming forward for a special blessing. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to take this with me. There we go. I'm going to ask everyone please to rise because we're going to come and bless you before the ark. Okay. Come stand right here. Face towards me, angle a little so you can see them too. So friends, as I just mentioned, our Torah portion this week has these dietary laws in it about clean and unpure animals, the system of kashrut. The root of that actually is the word kasher, right? Which actually has nothing whatsoever to do with food. Kasher means fit or proper or appropriate or right, as in proper for consumption or appropriate to be eating or making the right fit. When something's legitimate, we say it's kosher, right? Well, Ricky and Allison, I think it's clear to those who know you that the two of you are kasher for each other, that you are the right fit for each other, that you are appropriate and good and proper for each other. From the time that you met back at Purdue at the fraternity sorority tailgate party, through all your conversations on Facebook and the connection that you made, Now it's up to 8 years of dating, right? Some of that long distance, some of that thankfully now close and in the same place, in Indiana, in Florida, in Chicago. You have been each other's kasher, right match. I asked you about each other, what you loved about each other. Allison, you mentioned to me, you told me how much the two of you are teammates, that you have fun together, a good time together, whatever it is that you are doing, how kind and how good Ricky is to you and to everyone that he treats in that way. And Ricky, you echoed all of that. You told me that Allison is your best friend, that she challenges you to be your best, that she is smart and successful and loving. You both spoke to me of the strong belief that you have in each other, of the support that you've always given each other. I'm not crying, you're crying. You told me that the best part of your day is when you get to see each other. These are the things that make you kasher for each other, that make you right for each other. These are the things that make this new family that you will be creating one of joy and of love. And so tonight we're going to ask for God's blessing on you as you prepare for your wedding. There's a part for me. There's a part for all y'all, for the congregation. And then they're going to have some sweet blessings that they're going to bestow upon you. So here's our blessing. And Paul or Neil, you can put that up on the screen. Here's my blessing for you. May God, who blessed the great people of our past, bless this special couple. May God guide them always on life's journey. May their marriage be a joy and a good example to all who know them. May they fashion a home worthy of praise, where they find tranquility during all of their days together. May the love of this couple inspire and bless their family and their friends and their entire community. Together we all bless you now and say, may the love that binds them be lasting. Let their hearts be filled with patience and understanding. May their home be a sanctuary built on devotion to God, faith, and community. May they be blessed with health and courage, joy and laughter, as their love and friendship deepens through the years. We pray that they will enjoy good fortune together and find shalom together. Yevarecha Adonai ve'yishmerecha, may God bless you and watch over you. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'chunecha, may God's light shine on you, may God be gracious to you. Yisa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom. Ricky and Allison, may God smile on you in everything that your life has in store before you. May God bless you with the most precious of gifts and grant that it takes place in a world of shalom, a world of peace. King Yehiratzon, may this be God's will. And together we all say,
Amen. Amen.